Hi, and welcome to Better Together. I'm Jan Bottolari, editorial director for Paper 360 magazine, and I've been writing about the pulp and paper industry for about 30 years. On this podcast, I'll be speaking with industry thought leaders from the pulp, paper, and packaging industry. Today, we will be speaking with Thomas M. Nelson, author of the book One Day Stronger: How One Union Local Saved a Mill and Changed an Industry, and What It Means for American Manufacturing. The book has just been released from Rivertown Books. Tom has been county executive of Outagamie County, Wisconsin, since 2011. He served three terms in the state assembly, including one as majority leader, one of the youngest in state history. He developed his passion for public service from his parents, who founded a Lutheran mission church in Combined Locks, Wisconsin. Tom holds degrees from Carleton College and Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. He lives in Appleton and is a 2022 candidate for the Wisconsin Senate. Welcome, Tom. We're really excited to have you today.
Good to be on. Very exciting.
Great. So in your book, you mentioned that you grew up in Paper Valley. You grew up in a papermaking town. You knew many families with ties to the mill. So tell us a little about what that was like for you, how it shaped you and your, you know, growing up.
Well, when we moved here, I was 4 years old. My dad, this was his second call. He was a Lutheran minister at the time. And so it was a call to start a mission church in the heart of the valley, which includes Combined Locks, Little Shoe, Kaukauna, and Kimberly, which is, I guess you could call it the heart of the Paper Valley. And so there were several mills. And growing up in the 1980s, all the dads on our block worked at a paper mill. I mean, not every single one, but most of them. And so my dad, a Lutheran pastor, I like to say, wore the white collar, and the rest of the dads wore the blue collar. That's really funny. So, yeah. I mean, it was unusual. I mean, it was an atypical education. I mean, I learned at a very, very young age the importance of serving your neighbor, literally in two ways. Number one, because of all my friends and their dads, neighbors. But then also my dad, the way that he started his church was to go door to door. And so not only did, I mean, you know, for a 4 or 5 year old, you know, seeing beyond a neighborhood is like seeing the world. And so we went door to door in all these different neighborhoods. And we saw the same thing again and again. You know, paper jobs were a big part of almost every single block. And so I learned not just the importance of serving your neighbor in the context of a church and what that all meant, but also in an economic lens. So my dad always said to me, not when I was 5 years old, but later on, he said, when it comes to politics, if you've missed the economic argument, you have missed the entire debate. What, of course, he's trying to say is the economy is fundamental to a political culture, to a civil society. And so that's something that he preached and something, a lesson that I learned and I carry to this day. I carried over to my public service where I literally followed in my dad's footsteps, knocking on the same doors that he did many, many years
ago. Right.
My public service began first in the assembly and now as county executive.
Yeah, so it really is similar. It's a type of ministry, just with a different sort of venue. And I love how in the book you talk about folks saying that the mill is just this constant running presence. It's this comforting kind of through line through the life of the community, through the life of the economy. I always, you know, I've met hundreds of papermakers, and there really is something special about them, I think.
It is. And what you paraphrase, that's from Mark Van Stappen, who was a mill worker at the Kimberly Newpage Mill, which unfortunately was the one that was shuttered in 2008 and ultimately demoed. And, you know, this is a very good example of someone who, with a high school education, went into the industry and basically rose to this technician level. That would be the same thing if you had an engineering degree in paper science or paper chemistry, whatever it might be. And I don't want to jump around too much because there's also toward the end of the last chapter. And I do understand the irony that a book about insolvency law has 11 chapters. But in chapter 11, we kind of talk about how the evolution of a paper job for many, many years ago is a highly, highly skilled and a very, very well paid position because of how the industry has evolved and because of the labor movement. And it goes hand in hand because all of those jobs on Carolyn Drive and all throughout the Harlem Valley were union jobs. And I saw firsthand, I mean, in every driveway, you had a boat. And every household had a cottage on the lake up north. And, you know, my dad looked at that. I'm like, wow, I got 8 years of, you know, 2 degrees. And, you know, these folks that crossed the graduation stage on a Friday, went into a mill on Monday were pretty well compensated.
Yeah.
But, and that also goes back to my point about the American dream. Now that really, I didn't realize at the time, of course, but that really was the American dream where you had these good jobs, you had good schools because you had a good property tax base that attracted teachers. And the Paper Valley has always been a great place to raise a family. Consistently ranks quite high in these indices, these national rankings. And all of that was a virtuous cycle. Mm-hmm. And all that enabled all the great things that came out of those communities. And to an extent, it still does. But Mark Van Stappen was a really good example of just an ordinary regular paper worker who took to that job, really lived and breathed that. And the way that he talks about it and how he animates these conversations. I have a book here and I was just trying to, like, I was going to turn to a page and read these passages, but I see you've dog-eared quite enough if you want.
No, if you want to. I think listeners would just love to hear a passage.
Yeah, this is again, Mark Van Stappen, and he was several years at the Kimberly New Page Mill, which is in Kimberly next door to Combined Locks, the one that unfortunately was the one that shuttered. And I appreciate very much this interview because, as you can see, I'm not quite skilled in flipping through and keeping a conversation going. All right. So, yeah, this here he talks about traditions. So he met me at this, at Seth's Coffee in Little Chute, his hometown and my hometown. And I did a lot of my interviews there. So he says, as he sat in the corner booth, Van Stappen shared a memory from a happier time, his wedding day 30 years earlier. The ceremony was held in a small country church built in the 1200s outside his bride's hometown in Denmark. Van Stappen had never seen anything that old, and it fascinated him. How could anything 800 years old still exist? Mark dug into the church archives and went into town to talk to the locals. What he discovered amazed him. It explained who the Danes were and who Americans were not. Cultures that really grab and hold on to their history, they are not so easy to move, Mark said. Traditions mean so much. Paper was part of ours. I don't know if the new pages of this country can appreciate that. The Danes are considered progressive, but at the same time, they value tradition. There's no reason why we can't have it both ways. And yeah. There are a couple of passages, too, where he was just very, very passionate. And even though he was not a Combined Locks mill, he was an Appleton coded worker. And this is, you know, one of the reasons why I interviewed so many people, because there were... There were so many other stories that were just fascinating about this. I mean, it wasn't just here's an interesting industry and how we can learn so much, but it's also something that was really a part of. Okay, I can't find the next one, but anyhow, I think that's a very good passage. I have to get better at these. But
yeah, no, well, that's okay. That's okay. You're just the book is really new still, so you're just kind of getting used to these where you're the star author. I'm excited to interview. But you know, I remember reading that passage and I thought, what a great way to sum up the paper industry, really. At least in the US, it is in some ways, a very forward-thinking industry. And you mentioned this towards the end of the book where, you know, we're looking at nanotechnologies now. Mm-hmm. We're looking at Industry 4.0. We're looking at digital twins and virtual reality where you can literally walk through a mill that's hundreds or thousands of miles away, you know, this technology and how progressive and exciting that is for young people. And yet we also, especially in North America, we have mills that are 100 years old. Yeah. You know, we have mills that have been parts of their communities for decades. We have some technology. I mean, North America has some of the oldest on average, papermaking technology in the world. So we as an industry, I think we really do combine that idea of tradition and an industry that generations of families have participated in. And yet we're also on the leading edge of a lot of new technologies, right? So I wish we could get that message out more to people looking for a career that can be really exciting and fulfilling.
I mean, what we have to get over is this false narrative or conventional wisdom that's completely wrong. And that is, it's a dying industry. I make two points about this in the book. Number one, one of the reasons why there wasn't an outpouring of community support was they were taking signals from the Republican Party, because Scott Walker was not, I mean, it's just a fact. They were focused on Foxconn, which was a really good comparison. I'm not sure how much of that you saw about that, but that was a really good comparison, not just the value of paper industry and paper jobs, but the exact wrong kind of economic development strategy. You should work with your comparative advantage, your strong suit. And that just wasn't a focus. But the other reason why the community in general didn't come out is that they just written the obituary for a paper. And so it's really ingrained. It's not like away from the paper valley, from other states beside perhaps Maine and Wisconsin. Oh yeah, paper, it's a dime. And even right here, in the highest concentration of paper companies and facilities, that is the conventional risk wisdom. I think that example just goes to show just how challenging it is to cut through this assumption that it's, and right here in the backyard, that just goes to show how difficult is it. And then you have, and I'm running for the U.S. Senate, so I'm not going to give too much commentary, but there was the incident when Ron Johnson came and spoke. And I asked him a question, because it was in the wake of all these closures or these possible closures. And I asked him, you know, what can you do? You're a U.S. senator. And he compared the paper industry to the buggy whip of 100 years ago. I just kind of fell off my chair. And, you know, here's someone who, you know, he married into family. And Kerwood Smith, he was his father-in-law, I think. And he was a major figure in the paper industry. And so Senator Johnson was part of that industry, and that has made his family very, very wealthy. So even someone like that, so you're not just talking about the community that could be directly related or tangentially connected to the industry, but then also someone who had a job running a company related to it. So again, it is going to be difficult for us. It's going to be difficult for paper. And my book, part of my book, the objective was to show here in my hometown is an industry that people are writing off, but it is alive and well. And there's this unique solution to try to advance this in industry to keep, you know, the Carolyn drives, you know, thriving across the paper valley and across the world. And that is a labor union, local management, local government tripartite model that we used in succeeding with Appleton Coatim. The same strategy we did with Flambeau River Paper in Park Falls up in the Northwoods. We did it once, and we can do it a second time. And that's just here. And incidentally, I'd reached out to the international vice president for the United Steelworkers at some point. I had a question. She took the call and she said, I can't take the call because I'm in a bankruptcy proceeding. Oh. So, you know, there's all these things going on right now. And I think going forward, not just the next 5 or 10 years, but like right now, the next few months and years, that is what makes this book so relevant. And that's a big reason why I wrote it.
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully if this past year of, COVID-19 has taught us, you know, one small lesson is that paper is essential. The paper workers are essential. And we're a very strong part of the American economy that can't be written off. So you mentioned the Appleton Coated Mill and the story of how you kept it from closing with this kind of cooperation. Just kind of put in a nutshell for listeners what that main thread of the book, the story that tells.
So what I did for the history chapter, and the history chapter was something that my editor encouraged me to do. And by the way, if I had not lucked out, I had such a great editor. His name is Hillary Hintzman. He's retired. He used to edit for Norton Books, and her publisher was in charge of the Random House Time Warner publishing line for business books back in the 1990s. I basically got them on board through a cold call because they saw the story. from a distance. Like, that's Unique's story. You need to tell this, and this is how we can help you. And so Hilda and I sat down, and it was a really difficult chapter to write because there were 5, 6, 7, 8 strands or strings connected to it. And what we did is we used the history of Appleton Coded from 1889 until present as kind of a spine. And so there were all of these milestones and watershed moments in the paper industry, local history, the environmental movement, governmental, you name it. And so
all related.
We had to write, All related. I mean, we had things as despair as immigration policy, as the Wagner Act, the PCB cleanup in the river, the rise and fall of other industries, how other, about other industries, the movement, the roots of going from the flower industry to farming to the paper industry. And so that, as I mentioned before, offline, it took me 8 months to write that. But like the rest of the book, it was important to get that story. As a student of history, history can tell us so much, really illuminate so many issues we're trying to deal with right now. And I just couldn't write that book without that perspective. And I think people who have read the book, or commenting, and even though they don't specifically talk about the history chapter, I know in their questions and their feedback that they would not have taken those lessons away. They would not have understood the story without the history chapter.
Yeah. Well, you can't look at the paper industry out of that context. It's been part of our country for more than 300 years. Mm-hmm. And, Denmark has a longer history than us, as a settled nation, but certainly it's part of American history that's really helped shape this country, I think, and particularly, the Paper Valley area. So you tell the story of this mill that was near closing and how that local action, the cooperation, was able to change its fate. And the mill needed to make some changes in order to thrive. And that comes down to leadership in part, right? Mm-hmm. So tell us a little about that. And tell us maybe as a local civic leader, what you learned about the leadership in the paper industry that helps mills thrive, that can help mills adapt and meet these challenges, just from a leadership perspective.
And that really comes down to it. I mean, this story would not have happened had not been for leadership. And in the first chapter, I talk about the early days, the early moments that led up to the receivership case. And there was no way that we would have been able to keep Appleton Coded alive had there not been, first of all, the grounding of the receivership law that had been developed in the last 25 years. The law itself was 100 years old, and the antecedents goes back to 1880, side benefits and credit, the ABC law. So it goes back years and years, how creditors get paid when you go under. And that had been developed over the last 25 years. And incidentally, it had been developed by receivers whose chief responsibility was to sell something, scrap it, didn't matter what was going to happen to it, and get the main creditors, the banks, paid. But there were angel receivers, receiver attorneys that saw that there was a way to have a good outcome that would benefit all concerned. And so we took advantage of that. And of course, the initial people who were objecting to it were myself and the steelworkers. And the only way that I could have been part of this story, part of the narrative, is being a county executive. Because my argument was, from a county local economic perspective as a local leader, if this mill goes down, this mill generates $300 million worth of economic activity in one of the smaller communities in my county, combined locks population about 3,000. So you can think of you're talking like $10,000 per person. And think of how many jobs were at stake. And so because of the community benefit, I jumped in on that. And the steelworkers, of course, saying, look, our workers are owed $2 million. They're not getting anything. And there's a business model that we think can get this to work. So you had people with standing, myself. So you had labor leadership, local civic leadership. You had a very empathetic judge, a local boy, Judge Gill, who incidentally is running for the appeals court, and whose election is next Tuesday. A rising star. So we had to have an empathetic judge, and he saw that there was a way for us to get in to benefit all concerned. We found that. And, you know, that's how we got it going. And I think there's an example of how you had local business leadership. You had the local manager owners who weren't taking anything out of that, that they put everything. The only thing that they would walk away with is their pensions. Like that it, like that was it. And this was, they realized that they were the keepers of this tradition that went back over 100 years. It was their responsibility. One thing Mike Rask had said, you know, we're in the business of employing people. These are our neighbors. And so it was, so you had, you know, leadership from the management owner side, from the labor side, from the community side, and from the judicial. So it's kind of difficult to run the traps though, but if you think about it, if you have a caring community, you can do it. And that's what happened in Park Falls, and that's what we're going to try to do in another city in the state that I don't want to get too far ahead of it, but if it comes together, it will be very exciting.
All right, we're going to pause, and we will be right back after a brief word from our sponsors. The Better Together podcast is sponsored by Paper 360 magazine. Each issue of Paper 360 includes timely and relevant feature articles, new technologies, market trends, executive interviews, and much more in both print and digital format. Published 6 times a year by TAPI, Paper 360 reports from around the industry, around the world, with engaging content about the pulp, paper, packaging, and bioresource industries. Just like the Better Together podcast, Paper 360 is about connection, connecting readers to the trends, topics, and information that can make a difference to their professional lives. Subscribe today at paper360.tappy.org. Okay, let's get back to our conversation on the Better Together podcast.
We call the podcast Better Together because certainly coming through the pandemic, TAPI has found that that's really true, that when you can sort of work together to address these challenges, that's really the only way. And our industry is so large, but also so ingrained, into our communities that's really the only way. The book's subtitle and what it means for American manufacturing. So you look at the paper industry I'm biased, but I think it's one of the quintessential American manufacturing industries. It's our raw material is here. Our consumers are here. But we're also global and we can serve that global market. It's something I think America can really be proud of, its technology, its workforce. But we're facing some challenges, right, in manufacturing. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges that American manufacturing faces overall? And where do you maybe see some solutions?
You know, my mom used to say to me all the time when I thought I couldn't do something, and she just simply said, it's all in your head. It's all in your head. You know, if you really want to do something, put your mind to it and you can get it done. Same thing for manufacturing. I think what's in our head right now is that we can't do it. Paper is a dying industry. Manufacturing is a dying industry. We've had these trade deals. We've had this movement of jobs, manufacturing jobs overseas. It goes all the way back to the 1970s and more recently, I guess, the 1980s, when our competitors, Japan at the time, West Germany, they all had a national industrial strategy. And that included, you know, tariffs. That included subsidies, that included trade deals, that included, research facilities like what we had, the paper science industry, which later on in the 1980s just kind of withered on the vine. And up here we lost a lot. And, you know, there hasn't been, there hasn't been a similar research facility since then. So there were a lot of things. So not only is it in our head do we think that's not there, but that has led to our actions. And our actions have been quite destructive as far as the industry goes. They say nothing about the labor movement, which of course is part of that. So you had mentioned that this is a quintessential American manufacturing. And you're exactly right. And even though it's been difficult to convince people that this is not a relic, look at COVID, look at what we just did. Yeah. Look what we just went in last year. We didn't have ventilators. It took us a while to do the vaccine production. A lot of those issues is we had production overseas. And I think there's a pretty good argument like those are national security industries. And that's on one end. But then the other end, on a very practical level, different than those, is paper products. If you went to the grocery stores at the beginning of the pandemic, I mean, you had the soup aisle. You had soup cans. Soup was there. You had dairy. But you went to the paper aisle, and that thing was just nailed. There was nothing left. Toilet paper, paper towels, just gone. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good example of a raw material and product that you've completely taken, you know, for granted that, you know, you hit a pandemic, you might not have it anymore.
And the container reason that it takes to get everything to our houses when we can't go out to stores and we're ordering online or we're ordering, you know, store side pickup.
And I'm so glad you mentioned it. And I can't believe I forgot this. My line when Appleton Coda was going down and there were three other mills that were going down, three other companies that were going down, I kept saying this again and again, which is, you know, brown paper is the future because of Amazon. I mean, what's Amazon? Amazon is a paper box on your front, you know, doorstep. And at the time we were projecting, you know, a drag increase in e-commerce. And of course, with the pandemic, it's just exploded. I mean, 15 minutes down the road, you have a distribution center for Amazon. And those, you know, mainly they're still boxes. In fact, you know, my books that came in, you know, a couple of boxes with that, but it has all of this paper, you know, cushioning and, you know, look at that. And that's coming from an Appleton Coated. That's coming from, and then we have, you know, paper related. There's also a company, Menasha, who's biggest, you know, who supplies all the tape for a lot of these companies, be it Amazon. So you've got the box itself. You have the scrap paper that's on the cushion paper that's in there. And there's another reason that this is coming back. I'm sorry?
Sometimes the molded paper that.
Yes, all of that. Liner board. Yeah, you name it.
I completely agree. And like we mentioned before, we're also, I think, personally, on the cutting edge of some new uses for paper, some new types of packaging, some new uses for cellulose and for lignin that are really exciting for our industry. So, that's really.
And lignin. And lignin, that was a big part of the story with the Flammable River paper, is that they had this interesting supply chain. And even after going through it so many times, I still don't have it straight there. But there was a lignin company that needed a source of lignin. And so that could come from Flammable River paper. It's now Park Falls paper. And that's basically what brought that mill back. And, you know, lignin is the other component on the trees that had just been discarded, but now you have another use for that. And it has the same properties as petroleum products, everything from fertilizer to an adhesive. And that's natural. And now you talk about how this is, when you talk about a green economy, when you talk about a green New Deal, green jobs, paper industry will go hand in hand because paper is a substitute for plastic, whether it's packaging, and paper in the way of lignin, that is also a substitute for bonding agents and petroleum products. Those are two very, very good examples displacing packaging and petroleum that's, well, not too environmentally friendly.
And I always tell people, you know, we can grow more trees, but we can't grow more dinosaurs.
No.
Oh, I love Jurassic Park, but it's a movie.
And Georgie loves dinosaurs too. My little 5-year-old sometimes gets angry and he takes a dinosaur. Take that, Dad.
You know, we're talking about some of these cutting edge technologies, and you also have a perspective to share about research for the industry, like a research institute or a way of cooperative research. that the industry really needs, you think could really help. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, one thing that we lost, and I think manufacturing in general, that this this country has not set aside enough money for basic science and research and development and paper. And I talked about the comparison of how much more Germany does when their economy is smaller, when the country is smaller, and they do even more than we do. And they have, I mean, they don't call it, you know, German engineering for nothing. I mean, they have a thriving manufacturing base in that, relatively speaking, you know, smaller country. So we need that kind of investment, but we just don't. You have some crash programs with some the paper company in Canada. Boy, it slips my mind. That are doing some, you know, but you just can't do it. You need to have these research facilities. And that was a genius of the Institute for Paper Chemistry. Here was a facility that they assessed fees or contributions from these different paper companies based on their production levels. This is all pooled together, and you have these research scientists finding different products for paper and how you can make paper more efficiently. And that's gone. And I think that's a big reason why this community has suffered, and why I think the paper industry in general across the country is also facing challenges. And this is an easy solution. I work with a fellow out of UW Stevens Point, Paul Fowler, who's just great, a brilliant mind, he just loves paper, and he just needs some resources to do it. So we have the intellectual capital. We do have the experience. We just don't have the commitment. We don't have the political will. And I like to see that change. And I'm not promoting my U.S. Senate candidacy, but that's also something that I would like to do. And it can not just be for paper, but it can be for manufacturing across the country. And I also think it's a good sign, too, that a number of that there's a bipartisan coalition of senators and members of Congress that want a manufacturing czar, and something that the president is very open to. And I think those are pretty good signs, too.
Yeah, I think that would be great for the paper industry. So what can we do just as, you know, industry people, just as folks within the industry, what can we do to help support that kind of culture where, you know, research is supported, where maybe our companies, you know, support research, our government supports research. What can we do?
I think we have to look at the paper industry as an asset that has value, not just by the industry itself, not just by the people who work there, the managers, the owners, but the entire community. And the only way that you can do that is dislodge the conventional wisdom that paper is a dying industry, and we need to have leaders. We need to have labor leaders. We need industry leaders. We need trade association leaders. We need to be constantly working the different angles, political, local, economic, cultural, all of that. I mean, the tools and the raw materials, the bits and pieces of putting this story together, this argument are there. We just need to have news.
We need, like, here's an idea. We need like a podcast that share.
Yes. Yes.
Continue this conversation about, you know, the future of our industry. How do you see the future of our industry? Like,
I think it's bright. I think it's bright. I think it's what we make. And I think if we approach it the same way we have maybe the last 10 or 20 years, it doesn't have a chance. But I hope one of the things my book accomplishes, and we're trying to get it to as wide, deep and wide an audience as possible, is to show that this is something that is very worthwhile to put our time and our money and resources. This industry needs a champion. And we have, just like a community champions a sports team that might be leaving a city or trying to get one. I mean, we need to bring this back into our local culture. Even here in the paper valley, yes, the paper industry is important, but it's nowhere near as important as it was back in Carolyn Drive in the 1980s.
Yeah. So we just got to kind of spread that word, support our students as they come into the industry. Well, I think that's great. I'm really glad to see that through your experience, you have such a positive view of our future. Thanks for talking to us today, Tom.
Great to be on. Great to be on.
I had a really good time, and we'll put some information about the book in the bio. And best of luck in your campaign. And thanks again.
Good to be on. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you
for joining us for the Better Together podcast. With each episode, we will talk with industry thought leaders about the topics and issues that matter to professionals in the pulp, paper, and packaging industry. We're sponsored by Tappy's Paper 360 magazine, and we'll be posting new episodes every month, so be sure to subscribe and share. We'd love to hear from you about what you would love to hear, so drop us a note at podcast@tappy.org or find us on the Tappy Connect platform at tappy.org. Better Together, bringing you the connections and conversations that can help us build a stronger industry.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Montague, President and CEO of Tappy, the pulp, paper, packaging, tissue, and converting industry's go-to resource for news, industry trends, and technical and management information. We hope you enjoy today's Better Together podcast. And remember, there are two types of people in our industry, Tappy members and those who should be. Have a great day.